I'd just like to take a moment while you're standing to offer a Dalai Lama's smile meditation. I don't know if you know this, he opens all his scientific meetings with this, and it's simply to look around the room, allow yourself to make eye contact, stay a little longer than you usually do, and if the feeling of smile arises, try it. And just notice how that changes the body, if it does, the body, mind, heart. So taking a moment, just seeing who's here. Beautiful Sangha. Beautiful humans. Don't always feel beautiful. And just allowing yourself to make eye contact. Let's sit. So the Dalai Lama says that warms up the room. Neuroscientists would say that we released all kinds of hormones and neuropeptides in looking at each other, maybe oxytocin if it was at all calming. And Barbara Fredrickson would say that is a micro moment of connection or love which keeps tuning up our nervous systems to be well. Tara Brach would say we wake up in a moment out of the trance of separation, know our connection. So everyone has their own experience. How was that for you? Did you notice any shift from sitting alone to being together? So tonight we're going to talk about this being together. And can this be a field for awakening together? I want to share some of my work with you with relational meditation practice. And talk a little bit about a new book, The Buddha's Wife, which I wrote with my life partner, who's here, right here. And do a little bit of relational practice. So I'm very, very happy to be here. I've been hearing about this community for years and years and worked with Tara Brach in the Community Dharma Leader Program. And I've always felt there was a very special community here. So I was supposed to come in the week of that big snowstorm, in whatever that was, March. So I was very happy today there was no snow. But just before we begin, I just invite you all to allow a relationship in your life to just come to mind. Let it come, just receive it. And a relationship that you would like to dedicate some work to where there's challenge or disconnection or confusion or really not knowing how to be helpful or how to move things in a better direction. Maybe a lost relationship or someone who's passed on. And this still can be relational healing. We're calling this to mind and dedicate this talk and our time together to the awakening in relationship, to healing, to knowing, to being together, to even the possibility of liberation together. Sitting together under the Bodhi tree right here in all the ways and moments of our lives. I'll get back to that, but it's such a iconic picture of the Buddha under the Bodhi tree alone. And what most of everything tonight, what I would really like to leave you with is a new image of sitting together under the Bodhi tree. And in the book, The Buddha's Wife, we were imagining into the story of she who stayed behind, of the women in the community, and I'll read you a little bit from the book, but her question, and it's the epigram of the book, and it's kind of the question that I'm working with in my own life and work and practice. When the Buddha returns home, Yashodhara, his wife, when they speak, she says to him, "Dear one, what would have been the benefit, what teachings and practices offered, had two or more sat together under the Bodhi tree?" So, in a certain sense, we're always alone and together, and I'm going to be deeply investigating and inviting you to investigate that in your lives too, of awakening together. I think that my own life, one of the kind of truths is that so much of my suffering has been in relationships, still is. And also some of the most profound moments of transformation, of healing, of release, of reconciliation, of peace have come through relationship as well. So both are true. There is suffering in relationships. We all know that. That's the first noble truth of relationships. No way around it. This human life. And there's also possibly, you know, we can investigate that and really see deeply into that and perhaps an end, a cessation, a freedom from suffering. Particularly for me, the relational dukkha, I call it. So much of it is, I guess the second law is that we can trigger each other's suffering, reactivity to each other. One person goes down this way, brings the other right there with them, and couples get really good at that right away, right? You don't have to look, move your shoulder a little bit, you know what's coming, and you go down the same road sometimes. So we can trigger each other, great reactivity, and we can learn, and this is a work I'd like to share with you, we can learn to practice together and actually create the conditions for deep release of suffering. And my own work has been teaching a form of meditation, insight dialogue. How many of you are at all familiar with insight dialogue? Yeah. It's a fully engaged meditation practice, insight dialogue in the Buddhist tradition, in the Vipassana tradition, where if you go on a retreat, there's noble silence the whole time, and the only time there's any speaking is on the cushion. Kind of turns things around. And the point is that we can cultivate states of meditative states of mind together. Your practicing mindfulness supports my practice. Your practicing tranquility and ease supports that in me. Your practicing opening into relationships supports that in me. So the guidelines of insight dialogue are meditative guidelines for deep, mutual, shared attention and intention to practice. So it's a meditative, relational co-meditation practice, which for me has been really offering me the experience and the sense of this is possible, this is truly possible. Up until that point, I still had had the experience of being on retreats, deep meditation, silent retreats, really achieving some beautiful mental states, and then feeling as soon as I started talking again that it was gone. And it seemed to me always that that dimension was missing in the way that a lot of the teachings have come down to us, and very much silent internal practice. So I feel like the other route for me was being a clinician, and for about 25 years, I would sit on my cushion every day and practice meditation. Then I'd go into work and sit on my chair and practice with my clients. And over time, those two things started to really interbe. And I really understood that the clinical practice was a form of practice, and that the field of mindfulness could actually be seen as a between space, not just within, but actually between and among us, and that we could practice mindfulness in that relational space. And that insight arising in that space, discovered together, was available to all. Not just internal insight, but insight that could arise in relationship. I call relational insight. So my clinical work for a very long time has been studying the psychology of relationship and really moving out of a self-psychology to a relational psychology, rooting that from the 1980s in the women's psychology, only because felt that women in the West in that era were still the carriers of this way of practicing relationally and being really assigned that task in the culture. But what we did was really to take self out of the center and the study of the individual separating out, which was the predominant model of healthy psychological development, and instead to talk about the growth of relatedness over life and working with connection and disconnection, both in terms of understanding human development, but also therapy and what's healing in relationship. So focusing not so much on the individual, but on the quality of relationships and really looking at the power of mutual relationships. That not mutual in the sense of, you know, 50-50, but in the sense of really deep joining and forming a we that had the properties of each person, but also something new, the we, the relationship. So there's awareness of the self, the individual, internal. There's awareness of you, and there's awareness of we, of how is the relationship moving and holding us moment to moment. So seeing with relational eyes, not just individual eyes. And this quality of what is it to be with? It's so much more than sitting next to. And, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but I spent decades really trying to understand what does it mean to be with, to sit with, to really engage in a deep way as to really what Martin Buber calls the IU or the between, the interpenetration, the knowing. Some ways we can talk about that as a collective, that is, your eyes and my eyes see more together. And it's not just adding, it's a process where we can join each other in moving into something new, creating and moving, co-arising into the new. So it's a quality of being with. It's also that quality of being with that really allows you to feel joined. You know what it is when you're with a doctor, and sometimes there's a sense of being held and a sense that that person is with you, literally joined. You're not alone. It doesn't feel alone anymore. You don't say to yourself that, but that's the visceral feeling. And in that joining, there's an enormous sense of healing often, of not being alone. Very powerful. So those were things we began to study in psychology, and it's been tremendously powerful for me to start working with this in a meditative frame and really looking at the power of mutual relationships to actually cultivate, as I said, the qualities of awakened mind and heart together with an intention to practice together. And to, there's an enormous, what I have found is an enormous sense of immediate accountability. I can sit on my cushion sometimes and daydream for such a long time before I catch myself. But when you're sitting there with me, my level of accountability is so great. It really brings a kind of awakening simply in that. It's a mindfulness bell to have eyes across from you. And I do believe that, as I said, suffering and facing suffering together and allowing suffering, this is the internal process we do of facing suffering, of learning to be with, learning to bring compassion and mindfulness. And we can do that together. The third aspect is that, in my experience, there's an acceleration that happens in an engaged field, concentrated field of meditation, when there's more than one person. It can be an acceleration of awakening. So just to take you to the story of the Buddha's wife and how we got there. I've been hearing this. Do you know, how many of you know the story of the so-called story, historical Buddha? Very little is known about the actual Buddha, but there is a parable about his life that's pretty well known, about his leaving the night of his son's birth, first and only son, without saying goodbye, in order to go forth, to go homeless, to seek enlightenment, to seek the end of suffering on behalf of all humanity. And that story and that icon been exquisitely important to me and millions of other human beings in terms of really upholding what's possible in this human life. What's the best of us? What can we really be and do? What is our true nature? And I've always felt a little troubled by what about his wife? What about his adopted mother? In the story of the Buddha, his biological mother was died 7 days after he was born, and he was raised by his mother's sister, his aunt, as his mother. So he had an adopted mother, which for me also, as an adopted mother, feels very sweet. But I've been wondering about them. It's always been a little bit uneasy for me to, but I've also gone along with it. And about 10 years ago, I really began to think more about what about the women? What about the wife? What happened after he left? And began to read about her. Actually, I was working with Tara at that time, and she really encouraged me. We talked about this and started really opening the door to imagining into the heart, mind, life of the Buddha's wife and his son, who came into the world and was left that night. So the story, there were about five things in the story that in the early suttas, and this is in the Theravadin tradition, the Pali Canon, about five mentions of the wife, one that he left that night, two that she tried to, was very in grief when he left and kept trying to find out what was going on and trying to do some of the practices he did far away. So was trying to stay in connection with him. About 7 years later, the Buddha came home, no longer Siddhartha, but the awakened one. And It was said that she was in great grief and he let her grieve, and that he went to her and told the monks that if she touched him, it would be okay because of her grief was so great over his leaving. It was said that she encouraged her son finally to seek his inheritance from his father, to really take his father as his father, so encouraged him, and he became a monk in the story and left to be with him as the youngest monk in the Sangha. And then later on, the women, this was the really inspiring thing for me, the story was that the women wanted, including mother and the wife and others, wanted to become part of the Buddha's Sangha many years later. And the Buddha was said to have said no twice. And so there's this beautiful story that the women shave each other's heads and go homeless, walk barefoot, take on the robes and walk barefoot hundreds of miles with all kinds of people watching them as they went. And then when they got there, the Buddha's attendant, who was trying to support them, said, "How about women joining the Sangha?" And the Buddha said, "Well, no." And Ananda says, "Well, but they're already here. They're right here." So this seemed to me to be, how did she go from being an abandoned wife to a member of this vital, spirited community that went in resistance together? And I began to imagine what was that path. And I went to Steve, who's my partner, who is also a novelist and a psychiatrist and playwright. And we started talking about how imagining into this story, and what arose was a fictional story, a spiritual parable of the wife and the women in the Sangha. And then the second part of the book is, how is this relational path of awakening, not going alone but going together, how is this arising in our time? What practices can support that in our relationships and communities? And finally, why is this opening into relationship and awakening together in community absolutely necessary in our time, when our collective suffering of racism, wealth inequality, global climate catastrophe is so much something we all have to hold together. So the collective suffering and the collective awakening seem to me to be the fruit of this path and why it is so necessary today. So as I said, the icon of the Buddha, beautiful icon. I recently was working with some adolescents and I passed around a little Buddha around the circle of adolescents and asked them what they saw. And, you know, the peacefulness, purity, goodness, integrity, dignity, responsibility were some of the things that they said. So there's really been a transmission through that icon. And I would like to also add that we can now add to that icon to think of sitting under the tree together. And so the story in the Buddha story, he goes forth, sits under the tree, meets suffering with mindfulness and compassion, awakens, and then becomes a great spiritual teacher to all. In this book, when Yasodhara, the wife, wakes up and sees that he's gone, she cries out in a scream, a wail, and the women come to her, especially the Buddha's mother, Pajapati, who has been experienced in grief herself since she received the baby when her sister died. So now she is aware that Yasodhara, the wife, is now in this human experience of deep and traumatic grief and also having a child to raise This is so often what mothers go through. So in the book, the key piece is suffering meets compassion in relationship, in the act of calling out and showing up for another. I just want to read you one little piece. When Yasodhara awoke, she woke before dawn to the cries of the newborn baby. Siddhartha was gone. All the blood seemed to drain from her. She looked down at the boy. The shock made her feel that everything she knew had broken apart, fallen out from under her feet, been taken away, become thin as air, unreal. A doorway to all she loved had been slammed shut. She couldn't breathe. She screamed. So there's the story of this deep grief and the cry of desperation, bringing to her the mother who shows up, in this case, inspired by the story of the Kuan Yin, the Chinese Buddha goddess of compassion, who is there for anyone who cries out in pain and suffering. She will appear. So in human form, the wife, Yashodhara, stepped into, in the face of this great suffering, deeper relationship. And the mother holds her in her gaze, in her arms, realizes she has to be present for her, and says, after her cries subside, "When my sobs stopped, I raised my head from Pajapati's breast and sat up, looking again into her eyes. Her gaze was penetrating and steady, holding me there as her arms had. And then, with care, she spoke to me these powerful words. 'He has left to find his way through suffering. You must do that here now. We are with you in this. All of us are with you. I know in this moment it is impossible to believe, but you must listen. I found a way. We will find a way. You will find your way. Your child needs you as Siddhartha needed me. A new door has opened for you, and you will walk through it with us. This is the path of the ones who stay, who endure, who come forth with each other in love. Like Siddhartha, this is your first taste of what everyone must feel of suffering.'" And then she said, "Tell everyone she must never be alone." So they surround her. But the iconic moment is the crying out for help and being met in relationship, and the possibility of this meeting of suffering and compassion in relationship and in community is really the core of this book. So the women form a circle in the pine grove, and they surround the wife, and after a while the circle itself becomes a sacred circle. They pray and they sing and they chant and they speak and they listen to each other, and the circle becomes illuminated. And it becomes a practice, a meditative practice that they do every single day and which holds them in community. This becomes a community of awakening. So in that, wisdom and compassion grow, and this is the path of community and relationship. After this circle is formed, Yasodhara herself becomes connected to individuals in the circle. She has this very special relationship with the mother. She is mothering the son, which is very central to her spirituality. So this path we call, and I think to me this is the path that most of us walk, of accompaniment, of accompanying others through the circle of life from birth to death, being with the first in-breath and the last out-breath. This path I call a devotional path, not to Buddhas or gods, but to human beings, to really. And I started with thinking about what kind of vow a mother or a parent makes when a child is born to be present. It's really a spiritual vow for life, if possible. and to be present, to grow with, to show up for, to do one's best, accepting what can't be done, but really intending to be a beneficial presence, whatever that is at any time. So this path of devotion in our lives to particular others, this is one of the pieces we take out of the story of the Buddha's wife and bring into how can we live in this way, how can we practice this, and what kinds of meditation practice supports this relational practice in our lives. And I'm going to just go through for this devotional practice for some what Thich Nhat Hanh calls relational mantras. These are really four images you can kind of hold in your heart that underlie relational practice. And he wrote them in a couple of different words, so I'm going to share the ones I feel most resonant with. These were, he called them relational mantras. They're ways of really concentrating the mind, of setting intention, of deeply kind of holding to what's important and letting go of other kinds of things. The way we did with the breath, we choose an object and we let go of what takes us away and keep coming back. So the four mantras I will share with you, which I think underlie most of our devotional practice. The first one is, Dear One, I am here with you. And the dear one is so beautiful because it's really loving speech, addressing the others, saying hello. I'm here with you. And the kindness of the dear one, even if you don't feel it, somehow stopping for a moment, and you can even change your voice, which can change your heart too. And I actually would say here that when all of these practices are also practices we can extend to ourselves as well as each other. They're just two different parts of the path. So I think probably speak more harshly internally to ourselves than to anyone, if anyone ever heard how we speak to ourselves. So I often will say in my teaching to choose a name you want to call yourself and try that instead of the ones. When you hear yourself calling yourself something terrible, or when you hear yourself calling another person, just kind of tenderizing to dear one, or however you want to be called. I am here with you. So the practice of being present is what we were doing with the meditation tonight, and it is a fruit of the meditation practice of being able to be in the moment, to be present here, now, and with you, focused, and that quality of joining, of attuning and receiving the presence of the other, noticing the body language, noticing just that sense of joining with you. The second mantra is, Dear One, I see you and it brings me joy. I see you. I see you. Not just anyone, but you. See you in your particularity. See the beauty. See the suffering. See the potential. See the joy. I see you and it brings me joy. So here he's really supporting us in finding joy in relationship. This is not always there easily, and it may be full of lots of other things, but is it possible to even find a moment of joy or a tiny light of joy? And actually asking us to really make that a practice to find joy, find action, that activities that perhaps that bring joy, or just heart joy, as something very, very important. And then the last two relational koans or practices are, Dear One, I see your suffering and I am here with you. So the ability to see the suffering and be with it. Not to have to even do anything or make it better or try to talk it away, but just as the First Noble Truth, there is suffering. There is suffering in each other, and the ability to simply be with that is the third element of this. The last element is, dear one, I am suffering, please be with me. I am willing to be seen. I'm willing to be vulnerable. I'm willing to ask. Don't always have to put it at the center, but I'm willing. I'm not hiding that. I'm not reacting to that. This, too, is part of being human, and I'm offering that to you and allowing you to be with that with me. So those four practices, those four mantras, feel like very, very valuable, deep kinds of intentions to bring to relationships. There are many, many ways of relational practice, including meditation practice, including just practicing mindfulness, practicing joy, practicing just even noticing the others being alive and breathing. So there are many, many new forms of relational practice. And finally, the dimension of these two dimensions of the relational and the internal, I would just like to offer as a shared path. Both are extremely important, and I'm simply saying this relational path has been less developed, the practice is less developed, the possibility less, probably because of the way the tradition has come down through male monastic traditions. And there's so much ripeness in the West now for working with the power of relationships. So I would like to just finish with the Buddha's last words were said to be a light unto yourself, seek your own salvation with diligence. Yashodhara's last words, the Buddha's wife, might have been, sometimes you need the light of others to see the way. Sometimes you need to be a light for others. And always the light will shine more brightly when two or more are gathered in spirit. What about the shared path? We might say every doorway opens to the path. All are necessary. There is no right door or right way. There are many dimensions. Sometimes in the dark night we need to find our own way or lead the way alone. Sometimes we need to rely on others, and always we can share our light and find a new brightness in community, which will reveal to us what we are only beginning to see alone. So just taking a moment now to remember the relationship that you've held in your heart when we started, and just taking a moment to just bring some dedication or some attention or some love, some intention. And I just want to leave a little time now before we end for some discussion or questions or observations or thoughts, or something that's touched you.
Thank you. It feels to me that focus on the self is one end of a continuum, and focus on the other is the other end of the continuum, and that it is not well for anyone when you are in one extreme. It doesn't go well when you are in one extreme or the other. Mm-hmm. One time I was a public aid worker, And I focused entirely all my energy on doing well, helping others. And I burnt myself out. And I had nothing left to give them or myself. And that when you have nothing for yourself, you have nothing for others as well. So both need to be a part of the whole that is you.
Yeah. The beauty of this practice of awareness of self, awareness of other, and awareness of the relationship is really the fundamental. It's not just you or me, but it's how we're also meeting to the quality of the relationship. The practice of the meditative practice is, I teach a lot of psychotherapists relational practice, and this one of the most, and to support that, one of the most important learnings is really that as soon as we get into the helping role in some way, we over attend to the other and lose the internal experience. So practicing both at the same time is really, really helpful. So we get to practice that, not just, we know it, but we often don't have a way to practice that. And that's, it's of course that, and then being able to shift and flow from sometimes the other, sometimes more internally, it's just how we live our lives and having that flow as well in the relational practice. Yeah. Curious if anyone else has wondered about the story of the ones who stay.
So I guess you could describe me as maybe being interested in the relational practice and interested in the potential for growth in my relationship with my husband, were we to go down that path together. But at least thus far, his reaction is, it's not my kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so I just wondered what thoughts you have about that.
Yeah. I think there's all kinds of practice, and we can practice being with a baby. We can practice, that's easy. Well, sometimes, right? Yeah. And we can practice with meditation partners and then practice that in all our relationships. We can practice, sometimes it's a beautiful thing when two people can share the practice. But it's not necessary for practicing relationship. It's one person bringing a quality of mindfulness goes a long way, and it does for sure. And finding ways of practicing together that might not be your way are also goes a long way. So it's not necessary for both people to have the same practice, but it is wonderful when people can find the same practice. And I think there's many kinds of practices in life. I think chopping wood can be a practice together if it can be done with mindfulness. And finding a shared practice. It doesn't have to be either person, but some way of, I think there are some couples, my mother actually at 96 had a boyfriend, and they would sit and watch the sunset together. They were both in their late 90s, and watching the sunset, and then neither one was a practicing meditator, but they every single night in silence, just I thought, what a way to practice being that age, to watch the sunset and to do it together. You know, really share that experience in a deep way, I thought, is both an extraordinary practice. So creative finding it, but it is. It can be very painful when we would see how potentially beautiful it can be and not feel there's a way to do it. So that's suffering, too. Okay, let's just then take a moment and come back to our body sitting, just taking a moment, just appreciating, taking the time from busyness of life and sitting in presence together. Offering the benefits and goodness of our practice, of our lives, and of our relationships to the freedom from suffering, ourselves and all beings. May all beings be safe and protected from harm. May all beings be free from suffering and the roots of suffering. May all beings live with ease and with joy. May there be peace. Peace within us. Peace between us. Peace all around us. May there be peace.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit imcw.org.